For Wednesday, May 16, 2007. We've got a number of bills on the agenda today, and I intend to take them in the order in which they appear here, the notice of the meeting. So I will begin by opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 109A. Councilor Cummins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 109A repeals provision in Oregon law that establishes the amount of fees that charitable organizations must pay when they file reports with the Department of Justice. Instead, it requires the department to establish a graduated fee schedule, no less than $10 and no more than $400, with the amounts based on a charitable organization's receipts and income. It also requires the department to set a filing fee based on a percentage of the organization's fund balance of not more than 2% of the fund balance or $2,000, whichever is less, 0.02%. It requires the department to ensure that fees that they collect are sufficient to pay and may only be used to pay the department's expenses in administering Oregon's Charitable Trust and Corporation Act and the Charitable Solicitations Act. The bill requires charitable organizations to pay delinquency fees set up by the Department of Rules, set up by the Department by rule, if they fail to file the required reports or pay the filing fees. It permits the department to impose a civil penalty of up to $1,000 on a charitable organization if it fails to file a report or pay a fee within 90 days of receiving notice of a delinquency. And it permits the department to order a charitable organization to cease soliciting contributions until the organization has filed a report or paid a fee.
Thank you, Council. Mr. Boss.
Chair McPherson, members of the committee, my name is Fred Boss. I am Chief Counsel of the Civil Enforcement Division of the Oregon Department of Justice. I have submitted written testimony. I am here to testify in support of Senate Bill 109. Senate Bill 109 authorizes the Attorney General to set charitable registration and report fees by rule. The Attorney General has oversight authority over charitable assets and charitable activities in Oregon. The program that oversees these organizations and this activity is funded from the charitable registrant's annual report fees, which are currently set by statute. These fees have not increased in the last 20 years. The charitable oversight program receives no general fund revenue. The shift from setting the fees in statute to setting the fees in rules will provide greater flexibility and ensure that the program is adequately funded in the future. Senate Bill 109 includes other provisions to improve compliance, including an increase in the maximum civil penalties from $300 to $1,000 and an administrative mechanism to enjoin organizations from soliciting until they have complied with the reporting obligations. Additional amendments, which were on the Senate side, provided that appropriate caps on the amount of any fee increase the department can impose by rule and includes provisions to ensure that the fees can only be used by the department to finance charitable oversight. I'm happy to answer any questions which you may have.
Any questions for Mr. Boss? Representative Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Boss, thank you for your testimony today. Can you tell me what those fees are today? I was trying to find that in the bill earlier this morning. And
Chair McPherson, Representative Cameron. Currently, the charitable organization fees are twofold, or set on two bases, and they are set on the income and receipts, and then also on the fund balance. And if you look at A engrossed Senate Bill 109, in the second page, the in the middle, the fees now, as far as income and receipts, are $10 if there is no income or receipts, up to $25,000, and then goes to a maximum of $200. So the fee that is based on income and receipts goes from $10, a sliding scale from $10 to $200. If it's based on the fund balance part, it is 100th of 1% of the fund balance, and that goes up to $10 million. Also a sliding scale. That, I believe, is capped at $1,200. So we would be increasing the caps that are in the bill, in essence, double that. However, those are caps. And so what this bill allows us is to set the fees by rule with a maximum of double the current amount.
And the current amounts are in the italics from lines 14 down to lines 38.
Thank you. So can you give me an example of a charitable, or I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
I follow up. Can you give me an example of a charitable organization that has just an example of what the worst case scenario would be today that they're paying versus if this law is enacted and we went all the way to the top of the caps, what they would be paying? Has that number been done on a specific size of a fund?
For the largest maximum organization, the largest organization with a large fund, a fund over $10 million and with income over $1 million, they would currently pay $200 plus $1,000, so $1,200. If the bill passes, they would pay $400 plus $2,000. Let me clarify that.
Cap.
That would be the maximum they could pay, assuming that we went through the rulemaking procedure and put and used the maximum ability.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Boss, you also didn't mention a balance, ending balance, because I know some of the nonprofits I've worked in, there's a max you can have for a balance or in your account.
That Jim McPherson, I'm not certain about that. It's my understanding is that when calculating the fees, we just take a look at the fund balance.
Can you follow up?
Go ahead.
Because I know that it's always that may be federal or something that kicks in as far as your federal taxes. But if your ending balance gets too high, I know that you start giving scholarships out or something.
Representative McPherson, Representative Wisnett, I don't think that applies here, and that's not the issue here.
Thank you.
Mr. Voss, it'd be helpful for me and maybe for the members of the committee to describe what it is, and I think it's probably not changed by the bill, but what it is that triggers the obligation to be filing these reports and paying the fees. That is, if I have a small nonprofit organization that's undertaking some civic purpose, what kind of activities? Is it the solicitation of contributions that triggers this? Is it, or is it simply having a nonprofit corporation? What invokes this set of requirements?
Chair McPherson, the charitable organizations are regulated by the Attorney General in the state of Oregon. So merely the fact that you have a charitable organization, you must register with the Attorney General. You must also, you have tax benefits by being a charitable organization, so you file a federal tax return, what in the charitable organization field would be a tax return. And you also file that with the Attorney General. So the fact that you have a charitable organization, you have an organization that is engaging in charitable activities, which is can be the solicitation of money and also then the paying out of money, scholarships, whatever. That charitable activity, if you want to take advantage of the tax benefits and you file a tax return with the federal government in this area, then you also register with the Attorney General. We then have oversight. We review that to make sure that it is indeed a charitable organization. If there's charitable solicitations, we monitor the marketplace more or less, make sure that everybody is on the up and up and that kind of thing.
And sort of a follow-up to that, then, is it the solicitation of contributions from the public that is the focus of the department's oversight of these organizations, from the fact that somebody's going out and asking to get contribution dollars in. We want to make sure that they're applying those dollars for the purposes that they claim they are.
Chair McPherson, that is one aspect. We also make sure that the charitable organization is operating correctly, that it's not for the benefit of, say, one person who is draining the charitable assets. We make sure that the charitable assets are invested properly, that they the people are not abusing the corporate shell or the trust shell to make sure for their own purposes. All aspects. We make sure that there are many different types of charitable organizations. Some of them are fraternal charitable organizations, so we make sure that the members have a proper say in the organization. Charitable solicitation is, however, one area in which we're extremely active.
Representative Krieger.
I understand that 10 to 400. Go back and talk to me about that $1,000 that goes to $2,000. I see it. Or the civil penalty, but where's that in here? I'm missing it.
The Chair McPherson, Representative Krieger, the $1,000 that has then a new cap of $2,000 is not on the civil penalty. If you have a charitable organization, the fee you pay to the Attorney General is based on two funds or two incomes. One is the income, a percentage of your income. The other is a percentage of your fund balance. So, say, for example, the Meyer Memorial Trust has a large fund balance. They will pay what a percentage of their income and a percentage of their fund balance. The fund balance, the maximum they can pay on the fund balance as far as a fee is $2,000. There is, in addition, in the bill, a mechanism in which we can ensure that people do pay their fees in a timely manner. Currently, if a charity does not pay their fee or file a registration and pay their fee in a timely manner, they can be assessed a penalty of $20, and that's just a flat penalty. That does not encourage necessarily timely filing, because it's $20 whether you are a day late or a year late. So we have put in a mechanism by which we can have a sliding scale of delinquency fees. In addition, if someone just flat does not pay, we can have an administrative proceeding in order to have a penalty against them.
Representative, follow up.
Yeah, go ahead.
On page 3, line 12 and 13, it refers to the department's expenses administered, and it gives these ORS numbers. What are those?
Those are the laws in which the Attorney General regulates the charitable organizations in the state.
It would appear then, because you get part of this ending balance, I guess that if you had two charitable organizations, same number of employees, same number of contributions, in other words, 50 contributions or 100, but if they were larger, one corporation or one nonprofit would pay a lot more fees because they had more money, but yet wouldn't be costing you any more to administer. How do you justify that?
The Chair McPherson, Representative Krieger, the fees go to the enforcement effort for the section that looks into charitable organizations. It is not necessarily such that because an organization has a lot of employees or a few employees or a large fund or a small fund as far as the focus of our activities. This is a a general fee that comes in, and we then essentially regulate the charitable marketplace. Those large funds or those large organizations do benefit from that. Our activities may or may not be concentrated on them. It may be concentrated on, and quite honestly is, often on fly-by-night organizations that are trying to take advantage of the charitable marketplace.
Further questions? Seeing none, then I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 109 and open a work session on Senate Bill 109. Committee members, we have a different approach to sort of fees falling out of date in this bill maybe than we have in some others, which is give regulatory authority within certain limits as the policy choice is presented by this bill.
Mr. Chair, I'll move Senate Bill 109-8 to the pass.
Senator Barker moves Senate Bill 109-8 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Mr. Chair, I see the increase here, the ability to increase this, I guess about 100%, double it, whatever that is. And I would hope that the department would, obviously we're giving them a little more leeway than we had before in statute, and that they would not, you know, go out and raise that. I didn't hear testimony that they were going to raise that immediately, but that they would use their flexibility wisely.
Mr. Chair, I apologize I didn't get here for the testimony to justify all this. I guess my feeling is that I want the Department of Justice to be able to recover their fees or their income to a certain point. And I guess I'm advocating, I want them to use it against the bad guys, but give the good guys that make the, you know, small mistakes, and it's just a volunteer organization. That's where I'm having my trouble, because I'm in so many volunteer organizations that people's not intent to defraud, or I don't know if we can do that. Can we say yes to go after the bad guys and no after the good guys? But that's my personal problem, and I'll probably give a courtesy yes to look it up.
Okay. I would offer the comment myself that it's not necessarily bad guys. I mean, obviously that's one of the functions, but one of the things that happens in charitable activity is that because there's not a profit and loss kind of discipline, sometimes things just don't get attended to as well as they should. And when I, many times over the years, have come into contact with small nonprofit organizations, and they're often run out of somebody's laundry room or with records in a shoebox kind of operation. And I think that when you're receiving funds from the public to undertake to do important things, and you're getting certain tax benefits, and the contributors are getting benefits, it is important that we oversee that activity. So, any further discussion? If not, then I'll call the roll.
Aye.
Is that covered by our new rules? I have to hunt the rules for that.
Yes.
Aye with a pause. Aye, may.
Aye. Senate Bill 109 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And Representative Comp, would you carry that bill?
Yes, sir.
Thank you very much. We'll close the work session on Senate Bill 109 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 302.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 302A permits a creditor to execute on a judgment of foreclosure even when the owner of the secured property is deceased. It establishes that if the money received from a foreclosure is insufficient to satisfy the debt, that the trustee may bring a claim against the estate in a manner that is consistent with Oregon probate law.
We have Patrick Wade from the Oregon State Bar. Wade.
Morning, Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Patrick Wade, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon State Bar. This bill is before you because of a problem that was created by the enactment of ORS 18.312 back in 1989. The prohibits the execution as an enforcement remedy of a judgment against property of a decedent. And the original goal of the provision was to eliminate the dismemberment of a decedent's estate by creditors on a first-come, first-served basis rather than to have unsecured creditors participate in distribution from a decedent's estate on a pro rata basis. The bill that was here is intended to clarify that a secured creditor who elects to enforce its obligations against the property that secures the obligation may in fact use the judicial remedy of foreclosure and execution to enforce that remedy. The existing statute could be interpreted to prohibit that. There's a conflict between this statute, 18.312, and the sections of the probate code, which allow secured creditors the option to rely on their security. And, of course, to rely on your security, you need to have some enforcement mechanism to actually implement that security. So the bill before you today would clarify that the secured creditor is indeed allowed to pursue those traditional statutory and judicial remedies to realize on that security in the event where a debtor either dies before or during the procedure for the foreclosure of the security interest. The bill does not really extend the rights of a creditor, nor does it extend any liability to an heir of a decedent. Those aspects remain unchanged by this bill. Finally, there's nothing in the bill here which changes the existing law with regard to the ability of a creditor to realize on a deficiency if the collateral does not result in full, if the sale of the collateral does not result in the full satisfaction of the underlying debt. But it clarifies that the creditor's procedure for pursuing that deficiency is through the normal probate process of submitting a claim or in the estate or in the small estate in a small estate proceeding. I welcome any questions from the committee.
Mr. Wade, is this actually a change in the law? I would have imagined that what would be happening already is that if you are foreclosing on property that's owned by somebody who then dies, you could proceed with the foreclosure. Is it really being put over into the estate now, the probate process?
Well, in actual practice, I'd say, Chairman McPherson, that the practice seems to be that the foreclosures are going forward. The purpose of this bill is to clarify that was always the intent. The problem is that the interplay of the statutes between Chapter 88, which controlled foreclosures, and Chapter 18, which controlled the execution procedures, have a little discontinuity because of the change that was made in 1989. But the purpose of the bill here is to clarify that the existing procedure was not intended to be changed.
But we're not changing what's actually happening. We're aligning the law with what the statute with what is in fact going on now.
That's absolutely correct.
Right, okay. Any further questions? Then I close the public hearing. Oh, Representative Cameron.
Yeah, just real quick, Mr. Chair, thank you. Is there any examples of where the actual, what you said, the actual practice that is happening did not occur as a result of this confusion?
Chair McPherson and Representative Cameron, I'm not aware of any. This matter came up in the discussion of the Oregon State Bar debtor-creditor section legislative committee a couple of years ago, where we discovered this discontinuity and the possibility that it might be a problem down the road. But I'm not aware at this point of anybody having had a problem implementing the foreclosure procedure.
Thank you.
Representative Krieger.
Yeah, could staff tell us, I noticed there were 8 no votes in the Senate. What discussion was there? And the people involved in that, I would have some concern. What, for instance, some of the judiciary members, what discussions led them to believe that they couldn't support this, and or testimony came forward that would, you know, give them question on the bill when it was in the Senate?
Thank you, Representative Krieger. There was no opposition to this bill in the Senate. I think Senator Beyer was concerned about some of the remedies of the heirs. But it's my understanding that this doesn't change the any opportunity that an heir would have to cure a foreclosure, they would still have under this bill. But I think he was just uncomfortable with it anyway. And I'm, to be honest, I'm not sure why. But there was nobody testified in opposition to it. But in the end, I think he just didn't support it. So, not sure if that answers your question, but you might want to speak with him.
I have to vote before I speak to him.
Right. but nobody testified in opposition to it. I can tell you that. So
yeah, it is a curious thing that the bill. But what seems like just a clarifying change drew a number of no votes in the Senate. So, Mr. Wade, can you shed any light on that?
Chairman McPherson, I'm afraid I can't. I wasn't present during the vote. I do recall at the original public hearing that Mr. Collinson referred to that Senator Beyer did have a number of concerns about what the effect would be on the heirs and the rights of the heirs to receive their appropriate distributions from the estate. And the bill actually makes no change with regard to that, but my sense was that the senator didn't have a comfortable understanding of what that procedure was, and but I can't speak to the actual votes on the floor.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Bonamici.
I can see where this may be perceived as we're permitting creditors to take property away from somebody who died, and in a big picture sense. And I don't think that that's what it's doing. It's not changing the rights of a creditor under existing law. It's just clarifying the procedure. And we were also told in another committee, and I'm not talking about these particular no votes, but we were told in another committee that there's a bit of a contest going on in the Senate to see who can record the highest number of no votes. So I'm not saying that that's necessarily true in this case, but just so that you're aware.
I'm not aware if our chair wants us to get. Do you want us to start that game?
Well, that road we don't want to go down. Representative Kahn.
Just a comment. The Senator Beyer's family is somebody that I've known my whole life, and just to put a little context to this, he was very young when his parents died in an airplane crash and had a sizable estate and investments and all this. And so I would almost guess that he has some personal questions and personal history on inheritance and debt and all that to make him really question it deeply. So
Council Kamenzing.
Yep. Thank you, Chair McPherson. And I can just add, when I first read this bill, the first thing I did was call a few probate attorneys that I know in Portland and ask them what their thoughts were on this and if they had any issues, and they all said that they didn't. So
thank you.
Except that helps alleviate any concerns that you might have.
Yeah, I said, let's say, and committee might make a comment, and Mr. Wade can respond if he has anything to add to it, that when people land us with a security interest in property, they expect to be able to realize on the remedy that is foreclosure on that property, and that's an important part of how we finance the sale of property. Probate, you know, there's a whole industry out there now that's aimed at trying to avoid probate because it is a slow and cumbersome process. And to have the sort of the foreclosure of on property that is not being, where a debt's not being repaid, held up through a probate proceeding just seems like a bad idea. Now, it's apparently not what's actually happening, but the bars brought this forward because they don't want it. They want to make sure that it doesn't happen. Anything to add to that, Mr. Wayne?
Chair McPherson, no, I think you've summarized that very well.
Okay, very good. Representative Krieger.
Chair, I'll be voting yes, but kind of reserve my vote for the floor if anything comes up in the meantime, and I would let you know.
And I would encourage you to do that, since it did. There were a number of no votes, that if there's something that we're not aware of here, that we have to make our best decision, but if there's something that comes to light, then by all means pass that back to me. And if there was something that needed to be, you know, need to take it back to committee, because this is, as I remind people about our Senate bills that come here, this is really its last significant scrutiny before it goes on across the floor for limited debate, probably, and then onto the governor's desk.
Right.
Okay, if there's no further any further questions, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 302 and open a work session on Senate Bill 302.
Chair, move Senate Bill 302A to the floor with the due pass.
Representative Barker moves Senate Bill 302A to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Hearing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Bonamici.
Aye.
Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Excused.
Aye.
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 Aye. Aye. Senate Bill 302 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Anybody in particular who would like to carry this bill forward? Representative Barker, then I appreciate that. Okay, close the work session on Senate Bill 302 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 303.
Thank you, Chair McPherson, members of the committee. Senate Bill 303A attempts to reconcile the garnishment statute with the fact that many employers offer direct deposit options to their employees and or contract with third-party payroll administrators. What it does is establishes that wages are not subject to garnishment if, one, the writ of garnishment is delivered within 2 business days before the debtor's normal payday, two, the debtor's wages are paid by direct deposit to a financial institution, or the garnishee uses the Oregon Department of Administrative Services or an independent contractor as a payroll administrator, and three, the garnishee issued instructions to the financial institution or payroll administrator to pay the debtor before the writ was delivered to the garnishee. The bill also increases the amount of disposable earnings that are exempt from execution to conform the amounts with the federal poverty line. And also before the committee are amendments, which are the, excuse me, I have the wrong file, the dash sixes would phase in the increase of the amount of disposable earnings that are exempt from execution to conform the amounts with the federal poverty line.
I'm looking for the dash sixes.
Should be a pretty big document.
It's
that. Okay. Let's see if I have that here in the file. Okay, we have Mr. Wade, and then we have Matt Marquis here as well. Gentlemen, I'll let you present in whatever order.
morning. Good morning, Chairman McPherson. My name is Patrick Wade, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon State Bar as the proponent of Senate Bill 303. This bill addresses a problem that we've been experiencing for the last few years with regard to garnishments of wages. Under existing law, garnishment garnishes all wages that are owed by the employer to the debtor as of the instant the writ of garnishment is served upon the employer. And what we're finding is many employers these days are offering employees options such as direct deposit programs where the employees' wages are deposited directly into a bank account, or alternatively, or in combination with that, the employer utilizes an outside payroll service to prepare and distribute payroll. In both of those situations, the employer is generally required to provide the appropriate information to the financial institution or to the outside payroll administrator at least 2 days in advance of payroll in order to allow those payments to be set up and made in a timely manner. And what the experience is, at least anecdotally with my own practice and that of other members of the bar, is that this when the employer receives a writ of garnishment, after those instructions have been delivered to the financial institution or to the outside payroll administrator, it's essentially impossible to revoke those instructions without really almost an act of God. And the purpose of the bill here is to allow the garnishment to be effective as to wages that are earned during the 90-day period after the garnishment is served, which is the current law, except for any wages that would be due for which those instructions have already been advanced to the financial institution or to the outside payroll administrator within that 2-day period. But other than that limitation on that 2-day period, there would be no other change as to the practical effect of a writ of garnishment on wages from existing law. The sections 8 through 11 of A. Engrossed Senate Bill 303 were added to the bill on the Senate side at the request of the Labor Commissioner, and I don't have specific testimony with regard to those amendments. So I'll entertain any questions from the committee.
Ms. Marquis, why don't we hear from you, and then we'll open up for questions.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Matt Marquis, representing the Oregon Collectors Association, and really only to speak to sections 8 through 11 in the bill and the amendment you have before you, the A6. The Labor Commissioner, Dan Gardner, and myself and Senator Vicky Walker all worked together in the Senate trying to craft a way to raise the wage exemptions for garnishment, and we agreed to doing a staggered implementation that would raise them one set amount when this bill is implemented, and then again on January 1, 2009. Because of the timelines we ran up against in the Senate, we were unable to get that amendment drafted prior to moving the bill. The A6 is that compromise amendment that we all agreed to that, as you can see, raises when this bill goes into effect, raises on line 13 of the amendment from 170 to 183, and then that same fee will raise again January 1, 2009 from 183 to 196. So we are, these are the compromise amendments that everybody's agreed to, and I'm just here to present those to you.
So, Mr. Marquis, the A6s, then, there's a lot of text here, but as I look at it, it appears that it's just... They're just dollar adjustments.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that's correct. The fees are found several places throughout the statute and in different forms, and so you have to go through and amend those in several spots of the statute. But the only thing the amendments do is change the amounts of the fees, and they are all increases.
And so I understand those amounts. There's a it's in relation to the federal poverty level, that is some federally determined, I assume a national standard about what income level below which a person is living in a condition of poverty. But is the adjustment for, say, from 170 to 183, is that what the federal poverty standard is for a weekly paycheck? Is it from 170 to 183?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I am not an expert on the federal poverty level, and this was the Labor Commissioner's idea to try to bring those up to the federal poverty level. I'm not sure that it's the 183 or the 196 after the bill is fully implemented with the last stagger. Honestly, I couldn't tell you the difference there.
Council Kellis. Thanks. Yeah, I did check, and I don't know exactly what they are. They do raise it to that federal level, and so, but it's not the 183. It would be the one that comes in 2 years.
So we're jumping in half step to get halfway there, and then we go, and then we jump in the second step to fully to the. And is that a receding? I mean, is that these are odd numbers, so I'm assuming that probably gets inflation adjusted over time.
Mr. Chair, that I do not know. I know that the intent was that what right now is $170 was below whatever the federal poverty level is now, which I think is 190 something, whatever it raises to, and 196, I think. I don't know when the federal government adjusts its figures. But I do know that the intent of these amendments would be to at least bring it into line now with those amounts, or at least in 2 years.
Mr. Chair,
Representative,
a quick question then for council. Would it make sense to make direct reference to the federal standards then and keep that tie rather than specific amounts?
Mr. Chair, Representative Reed, I suppose it could. I mean, there's something to be said for having some certainty so people know exactly what the amounts are. But that would just be a policy decision for you to make. So,
and otherwise. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, if I could respond to that as well. These forms are all laid out in statute and have to be printed exactly as they're laid out, and there's specific detail as to how the employer fills out these forms as to which amounts go in. So if there was not a specific dollar amount in the form, it would become become difficult for the employer to figure that out. And if you made the amounts change on an ongoing basis, you would create a huge amount of cost into just the redevelopment of the form every time that fee were to change. I'm not sure how often that federal poverty level changes myself, but if it is something that changes every couple of years, this body obviously does meet every couple of years, and we can look at it then.
I'm trying to understand how the bill evolved, because I was looking at the Senate amendments, and the amendments adopted in the Senate would have increased just in one jump from, say, the 170 would have jumped to 196. And is what happened that it was the adjustment of the federal poverty level was put in to the Senate, on the Senate side, and then a decision was made to stagger that. So it's the staggering that the A6s reflect.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that's correct. And just to give you a little bit of history, Commissioner Gardner, as he presented the amendments, had the amendments, we had been talking with him. Our client was pretty nervous about that big of an increase all at once, and we agreed that we could move those amendments forward with the idea that we would do a staggered amendment here in the House. There just wasn't time to get this amendment drafted before the bill moved in the Senate.
And I could just add to that, the amendments that came in that made it the full jump came in, I think, maybe the day before the work session. So it all happened very quickly, and that was very close to the deadline for moving the Senate bills. And so there was some discussion offline, and
and these amendments were talked about on the House side.
Okay. Representative Krieger.
Just up on line 8 in first page, 75% of the disposable earnings are exempt. And then you go on down and talk about these lines 10 to 12. Is that gross, net? What is it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, as to the amounts listed, is that gross net or the 75%?
Well, either one.
Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, I will have to look. I'm not 100% sure on that answer. I know that one applies over the other, but I'm not sure if that is gross net.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I think I can respond to that to some degree. The scheme of the garnishment exemption statute is that the disposable earnings of the individual are exempt to a certain degree. And disposable earnings means those earnings after you take out the mandatory withholdings for federal and state taxes and Medicare and FICA and so forth. And so the employer does a calculation on a form that's part of these statutes that comes out with the gross wages for the pay period and take out the federal and state taxes and all those other mandatory deductions, and that gets the disposable earnings of that employee for that pay period. And then the statute says that 75% of those disposable earnings are exempt from execution. But in the case of a minimum wage employee, there's an additional minimum amount that the employee is allowed to keep, which is in the second part of the section here, 18.385. So that we don't get to the point where the employee is taking home less than this minimum amount, even though that may be more than 75% of the net disposable incomes. So in the case of the garnishment of a highly paid employee, the employee will get 75% of those disposable earnings to take home. And in the case of a lower paid employee, the employee will get the greater of 75% or this minimum amount, which is going to be staggered upward over the years according to the A6 amendments.
So, Mr. Wade, just to illustrate with an example, if someone had a weekly paycheck of $300 and then the required withholdings would take that down to $200, then the 75% would be $150 would be exempt, but that would be overridden by the exemption of $183 under the A6 amendments. So it's 180. It would be only $17 that could be garnished, if my example is right.
I think that if I follow the math correctly, I think that's right.
Mr. Chair, that is correct, yes.
Okay.
Chair.
Representative Krieger.
My calculations are that they can't garnish a legislator's wages at all. We don't make enough.
Put that on the record.
It's on the record.
Playing cat and mouse for the federal poverty level. Chair. Representative Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have several questions. First one, what if the individual does not work full-time? Do the numbers of 183 and 196 still apply? Say the person only works 10 or 12 hours a week. Is there a prorated?
Mr. Chair and Representative Cameron and members of the committee, yes, that is prorated for the amount of that's worked during the week. So if the employee is a part-time employee, the amount is calculated appropriately.
I follow up if I may. Employer compensation, obviously this is a very complicated issue. Was there any discussion about changing the employer compensation on line 6? on page 6, processing fee, line 13, the employer is allowed to take $1 a week, but not until they've gone through all these hoops and made sure the debtor's paid off. Was there any discussion about that?
Chair, Representative Cameron, members of the committee, no, there was no no discussion of changing any part of the existing garnishment scheme other than with regard to this two-day problem and the stepped increases that are the Labor Commissioner's amendments.
Another question, if I may.
Go ahead.
Can you talk about the liability of an employer if they fail to operate within these very complicated guidelines? Can you talk about the liability the employer has?
Employer. Mr. Chair and Representative Cameron, members of the committee, the to sort of summarize that, if an employer fails to correctly respond to a writ of garnishment, the employer is subject to liability to the garnishing creditor in the amount of the greater of the amount of the wages that should have been held out by garnishment, or the amount of the judgment, whichever is greater. But that has always been the case under the garnishment statutes, that if a person served with a writ of garnishment fails to respond appropriately, then that person served, the employer, in the case of a garnishment of a wage earner, does face liability to the creditor. And that was frankly the motivation for the changes to sections 1-7 of the bill, is to make sure that employers were not faced with that potential liability when they were served with a writ of garnishment during that two-day period and had no practical way to affect the outcome.
If I may.
Go ahead.
So if somebody is receives a writ of garnishment of $2,000 to be deducted over a period of time, and they fail to operate, and I guess I'm concerned a little bit about even a two-day. We had a similar bill in this. Some employers that that are paid weekly or biweekly or even monthly, they may have already sent off their payroll more than a week ahead of time. And now they receive a notice 2 days before that payday, from what I'm reading this, and now they're obligated to go back and redo that payroll, even though they have a third party out there that's doing those types of things.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cameron, members of the committee, the short answer to that is yes, and that was discussed to some degree in the original version of the bill, which was before the Senate. The original bill did contain language which would allow an employer a defense if the employer could show that it was not reasonably possible to change the instructions that were given more than 2 days before the service of the writ of garnishment. But as part of the compromise that was reached with the interested parties in the Senate side, the decision was made to put the bill forward with just a straight two-day window rather than a two-day plus an indeterminate amount that would be subject to judicial review.
Thank you. Representative Krieger.
There are quite a few, thank you, Mr. Chair, there are quite a few small businesses, kind of mom and pop. They maybe have part-time employees, one or two, are they going to be able, may receive this notice, are they going to be able to, you know, we're talking about having a little bit of problem with it. How are they going to understand what they're supposed to do and what the percentages are?
Mr. Chair and Representative Krieger, members of the committee, that's often a problem for smaller businesses who don't have a lot of writs of garnishment coming across their desk to understand and to know what to do. But the forms that are part of the garnishment statutes have been designed and evolved over a period of years to try to clarify that in fairly straightforward and simple English. But I recognize that's always a problem for somebody who is not faced with this on a daily basis. But I think that also goes to what was referred to earlier about the wisdom of having the statute specify clear dollar amounts so that that eliminates some of the confusion on part of the employer, especially for these part-time employees that are working for lower wages.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, if I may just add very briefly, the Law Commission 4 years ago reviewed the entire garnishment mechanism as to how the instructions should be written, and we did a whole rewrite of the garnishment statute. And if you look at the amendments, we now have a very explanatory instructions of how to fill out the exemption calculation part of the form on page 4 and 5 that shows up. Each interim, we review these things, trying to figure out a way to make it the easiest way and possible for the employer. This is where we're at now, but I'm sure this next interim, we will continue to look at these instructions as to how it's easiest for the employer to fill out.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, it's my understanding that the forms didn't change or the instructions other than the amounts. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bonamici, in this bill, that is correct, but I was just... 4 years ago, we did an extensive rewrite of all of the instructions, and we also looked at what Representative Cameron was talking about on the reimbursement back to the employer, and that happened, I believe it was 4 years ago, two sessions ago.
Thank you.
Committee, before we close out the public hearing, I guess I'd like to get a sense about whether people are comfortable with where we are on this bill at this point. I do recall we had another bill, a House bill, that made some change in the procedure for garnishments, and I think we took into account some of the concerns that Representative Cameron was expressing in that bill, but I'm a little fuzzy about it now, and I don't know how that relates to this.
Mr. Chair, if you may indulge me for a minute, this bill, from an employer standpoint, is better than what we have today. Obviously, it gives you a two-day extension. My objection to this is the whole process that employers, and especially small employers, who get hit with something like this, the guy or gal's working his business 12 hours, 15 hours a day, they get hit with something like this, and I even had an employee come to me one time, I'll use a personal experience, that he had a bankruptcy, and the court said he could set up direct payments or they could just garnish his wages, and he says, "Oh, I'm just going to let you garnish my wages so I don't have to deal with it." The employer becomes the collection agency and the bank, and there's a huge amount of risk. There's a huge amount of liability. We heard the liability that's there, and I've witnessed it where an employer had to write out a check for $2,400 because they didn't understand this and didn't do it. So my objection to this whole I'm not going to hold up this bill today because it's better than what we have today, is you see there that the employer gets to collect $1. And I don't know how many of you know how much it costs for a good bookkeeper, or even some people use their CPAs that do their payroll and payroll services, but it's a whole lot more than $1 to the employer to set this thing up and to continue to process this thing, just cost alone, much less the liability they face if they make a mistake. And it's something that our businesses in this state continue to do to help collect child support, and I think it's a great thing that we do that. But this dollar is an issue and the time it takes and the liability. So, I mean, I'm going to support the bill the way it is because it's better than what we have today, but it's you just need to know where it comes from out of my craw.
It sounds like Representative Cameron would have some good ideas for a work group on this issue.
For further other changes beyond what is presented in this bill. I think with that kind of sense of where the committee is, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 303 and open a work session on Senate Bill 303.
Mr. Chair, I'll move House Bill 303 to the floor with the
Senate
Bill.
We need to take the dash six amendments.
Oh, we got it.
Mr. Chair, I'll move the
dash six amendments into Senate Bill 303.
Representative Cameron moves the dash six amendments into Senate Bill 303. Any discussion? Any objection? And the dash six amendments are adopted. Now, Representative Cameron.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 303 as amended to the House for, or I guess it would be the B engrossed, or it'll be a B engrossed version.
It would
as
end up being a B engrossed, yeah. As amended by the A6s.
By the A6s to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Cameron moves Senate Bill 303 as amended by the A6 amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Representative Krieger.
Chair, I would hope that they would, in fact, get together and take a look at some of these issues because we could, I know it's short now, we could address it next session and. The expense and liability to small business owners, it can be pretty overwhelming when you're working 12, 14 hours a day, and then you got to sit down and try to do your paperwork when you're tired at night, or hire someone at three times your wages to do it for you. So I hope they address that.
Yeah. Any further discussion? Hearing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Representative Forrest.
Excused.
Representative
Kahn?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Reed?
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker?
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnett?
Excused.
Chairman
Forsyth. Aye. Senate Bill 303, as amended by the A6s, moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Cameron, would this be a good opportunity for you to express some of the, you know, on the out and
it might fail floor? If I get it. No. Sure, I'll carry it.
That would be terrific. Thank you very much. I'll close the work session at Senate Bill 303. And open a public hearing on Senate Bill 729.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 729 requires a bicycle to be equipped with a brake that enables the operator to stop within 15 feet from a speed of 10 miles per hour on dry, level, clean pavement. It establishes that a fixed brake bicycle does not need to be fitted with a separate brake. Also before the committee are dash two amendments. The dash two amendments state that police officers may install sirens or whistles on bicycles.
Mark Kingsbury. Chairman McPherson, members of the committee, thank you. I'm Mark Ginsburg. I live at 6924 Southeast Amhill Street in Portland, Oregon. I'm an attorney in Portland. I'm always impressed by the sheer diversity of the issues covered by this committee, that we can jump from where we've been to the technical minutiae of bicycles. There are actually three separate components of this. The first is a housekeeping update. Oregon, like most states in the mid-1970s, adopted the federal model bicycle brake laws. At that point, we assumed bicycles had coaster brakes, a rear pedal backward coaster brake, so the test was make it skid. Since then, bicycle brakes have changed. Most of us, if we have a bicycle, it might have a front hand brakes, but our current law still says make the brake wheel skid. If you try to make your front brake wheel skid, you most likely fall down. And so what the first part of this does is it takes the current federal model language and just adopts that so that we reflect the reality of the current technology. The second piece is a clarification that a fixed gear bicycle, and what those are, imagine a big wheel when you're a kid. So the pedals are directly connected to the wheel. There's no coasting mechanism. And some people use those bicycles without an additional handbrake. And up in Portland, we've seen a split in the trial courts as to whether or not that has a brake or does not. Some trial court judges have felt that it does, and some trial court judges have
spell that it does not. So the one additional line just clarifies that those bicycles, so long as they can stop as required by the law, don't need an additional handbrake. And then the third, the dash two amendments that I'll touch on briefly because I'm not the primary proponent of those, are an additional bicycle, technical bicycle clarification. There's currently a limitation in the ORS that says a bicycle may not be equipped with a siren. The concern from the Oregon Association of Chiefs of Police is that a police officer on a bicycle, for it to be a police vehicle, must have a siren. So that's why they're asking for the dash two amendments. My understanding is no opposition to that. I know they've spoken to each of you. They're comfortable with the rest of Senate Bill 729. Beyond that, I'm happy to take questions, or I'm just happy to keep going.
Representative Krieger.
First, I thought it was, you know, humorous, but you're going to put a siren on it. Is it going to be electric, or is it going to be a hand crank? And if he's hand cranking it, can he drive one-handed without being in violation?
Only if he has a cell phone in use.
Again, they, in a very appropriate way, they took this as the opportunity, if we're clarifying and updating the bicycle laws, to bring their issues in line as well. So.
Mr. Chair, I was qualified on police bicycles, and we didn't have sirens on them, but that's fine.
I would also add that the Bicycle Transportation Alliance testified in the Senate side, and they are in support of this bill, the Bicycle Transportation Alliance, with the state level bicycle advocacy group, who I understand we're here. Doing the vulnerable users bill earlier this week, is that correct? Or last week, I believe it was. You know, and in essence, it's upkeep. The bottom line is it comes down to housekeeping so that we can make sure our bicycles currently obey the law.
Mr. Ginsburg, on a service more conventional bicycle where you have handbrakes for both the clamp against the rim, both front and back, how quickly at 10 miles per hour can those bring the bicycle to a stop?
I feel comfortable that it's within the proposed limits. The proposed limits come from the federal guidelines, and so the presumption is that the numbers they gave us, the 10 miles from 10 miles an hour and 15 feet, is very doable. My personal experience is I feel comfortable doing that, and I think most bicycle users do as well. That's not a rapid stop or a panic stop, but a very reasonable stop. 10 miles an hour and 15 feet is very doable.
And you say that standard, 10 mile, stopping from 10 miles per hour within 15 feet, is a federal standard for, is it bicycle design? Where's that standard?
Well, it comes from two places. It comes from 16 CFR 1512, which is the federal guidelines under the Consumer Product Safety Commission. When a bicycle is sold, it has to meet those requirements. If it's sold in a bike shop under the CPSC. And then, additionally, they use that as the guideline under the Uniform Vehicle Code, which is the language that we took verbatim and just used in Senate Bill 729.
So, in other words, we're making sure our statutes conform to the federal standard for what within under for consumer products, as to the distance within which a bicycle has to be able to stop, and we don't regulate how it has to accomplish that, just as long as there's equipment that will allow that to happen.
That's correct.
Any further questions? Okay, here. If not, then I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 729 and open a work session on Senate Bill 729.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash 2s into Senate Bill 729.
Representative Barker moves the dash 2 amendments into Senate Bill 729. Any discussion? Any objection? If not, then the dash 2 amendments are in the bill.
Move Senate Bill 729 as amended to the floor with a due pass.
Representative Barker moves Senate Bill 729 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Bonamici.
Aye.
Representative
Campbell. Right.
Representative Forrest.
Excused.
Representative Hoff.
Aye.
Representative Krieger.
Aye.
Representative Reed.
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker.
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnett.
Excused.
Chairman
Person. Aye. Senate Bill 729 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Reed, you're our bicycle guy, I guess.
Thank you.
I'll have some questions for you. Especially about sirens and whistles.
And my contact information is also in my public testimony. If there are further technical questions I can answer, please feel free to contact me directly.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Ginsburg.
Chair, could I request a visual demonstration on the House floor?
Well, I think we ought to get a fixie under the floor of the...
so long as I don't have to ride the fixie.
I think Senator Atkinson might be the best person.
We'll arrange for that. I think that would be a great demonstration to do.
Maybe we could.
Okay, I'll close the work session, if I didn't already, on Senate Bill 729.
And open a public hearing on Senate Bill 273.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 273A comes to you at the request of the Senate Interim Committee on Judiciary. This bill basically does two things. Allows the state court administrator to grant access to case calendars, case registers, and other case information that is kept in electronic form and that is otherwise not open to public inspection. Requires that any person granted access to records under this measure must preserve the confidentiality of the records. Requires the state court administrator to prescribe standards and procedures for access to the information. Also, the second thing that repeals sunset provision, that thus making permanent the 2003 Oregon law allowing the Cook Jefferson County Circuit Court to enter into an agreement with Warm Springs tribes regarding juvenile offenders who are tribal members. You see Mr. Travis in front of you. He's the person that brought us these two amendments in the Senate.
Very good. Mr. Travis.
Good morning. I'm Timothy Travis. I'm staff counsel at the Oregon Judicial Department for Juvenile Law and for Treatment Courts. Perhaps the siren on that bicycle could be powered with one of those generators that I used to have on mine that created my light.
Oh, yeah. So.
They had a siren that was run just like that you could buy from Sears. Yep. And I had one when I was a kid on the bike.
I knew it was a good idea. What we are bringing the committee today are two housekeeping provisions in Senate Bill 273. The first of these is the removal of a sunset from a provision in the Juvenile Delinquency Code. And that provision allows the court over in Jefferson County to enter into agreements with the Warm Springs Tribal Court for handling delinquency actions involving tribal youth off of the reservation within the tribal court rather than within the circuit court. And this is an experimental provision that was put into the law a number of years ago. And such an agreement was reached, and now there's going to be a revision of that agreement because of the change of personnel on the tribal court. The sunset goes into effect in 2010, and the reason that we're here in 2007 is that it's going to take a while to develop this agreement, and people are beginning to wonder whether they will get this agreement finished and then it will be mooted by the legislation sunsetting. So we're asking for the sunset to be removed today to reassure everyone involved in this negotiation that it won't be an act of futility to do it. So if there are any questions about this particular provision before I go on to the second, the other thing I should do is remind the committee that I am a juvenile law wonk. And I love to talk about this stuff a lot more than most people like to hear about it. So when you've heard enough, just let me know, and I'll pick up my toys and go. The second provision of Senate Bill 273 is a little more complicated than the first. The second provision has to do with access to the part of the OGIN system, the data system, that's called the register, the case register. The case register is an abstract of what's in what's called the legal file in a juvenile delinquency case or a juvenile dependency case for that matter. It also is the abstract of that file in things like a civil commitment. And what is in this register is a list of the pleadings in the case, motions, judgments, orders, and also an accounting of the dates, either past dates of hearings or future dates of hearings. And that's all that's in the register. There is nothing else that's in the register. The stuff in a juvenile delinquency case that would be things like psychological evaluations or police reports, the stuff that we technically refer to in the trade as the juicy stuff, That's not in the register. That's in a paper file that's called the legal or the social file, and that's maintained by the juvenile department. That is not maintained by the court. So what's in this register is a list of the pleadings and motions and process of the case, and then an accounting of the sort of the history of the case. This information is confidential, and it's confidential because of federal law. Now, there are some exceptions to that confidentiality for delinquency statutes or for delinquency cases, but nonetheless, this is confidential information, and it's not available to the public. It is available by law to people who are either the agencies who are involved in these cases or the attorneys involved in these cases or the parties involved in these cases. These people can have access to what's in the register because they need it to function within the case. Okay. Now, the problem we have with the, and we have provided this access to those people consistent with the law. The reason that we want to have this provision, which gives us the ability to create regulations governing this access, has to do with the nature of our system. As this committee is well aware, the OGIN system in general is not the best state-of-the-art computer system around. And with the register, we cannot grant access to a party to the case to only their case. You either unlock the entire register for someone, or you don't give them anything. So if I'm an attorney representing Lil Johnny in a delinquency case, if I'm to have access to the register, I'm also going to get access to the entire register, everybody's cases. Okay? Now, because people are officers of the court and such, we can control informally what's going on, and we have. But we would like to have regulation, as it says in my testimony, to be able to formalize this and to create boundaries and make it clear to people what they're supposed to do and what they're not supposed to do. There's very little danger that anyone can use what's in the registry improperly. Okay? Although there's at least one thing I can think of that someone could do to misuse that information. But in general, there's really nothing sensitive in there. So, and the reason that people need this information specifically is that lawyers need to be able to reconcile their case counts with PDSC. This is the most accurate record of what's actually happened, whether a hearing has actually happened or not. And the second thing that people can use this for is to check when a judgment is entered or when the next court date is in a particular case. And by allowing people to have access to the register, we take the burden off our clerks from answering the phone to answering these kinds of inquiries, because it's also difficult for them to know who's on the phone calling, asking. So those are the two things that access to the register does for attorneys general, district attorneys, and DHS and the Oregon Youth Authority. So as I said earlier, I could talk about this for a long time, but if you have any questions, I'd be pleased to answer them.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Travis. I have two questions, one about each part of the bill. What's happening currently to tribal youth who are alleged to have committed acts? Are they being tried in the court, or are they being tried in the up at Warm Springs?
Currently, Representative Bonamici, tribal youth who commit delinquent acts off of the reservation are part of the delinquency system in Jefferson County or wherever they commit the acts.
And my second question about the second type is almost a expression of shock and concern that the system is so bad that we can't allow access to just one case. And I wondered if there's some sort of, I'm sure it's already been explored, but is there some sort of technological revision or something that could be done to allow that? Do we really need to grant people access to the entire register in order to access one case?
As the system, with the system that we currently have, the only thing we can do is what we're doing technically. On the horizon, with the ability provided by this body, we are looking at a new case management system, which will do a lot of things that this body wants done with our system. And that system, as my testimony says, will be able to grant access solely on an individual case basis.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Then thank you very much, Mr. Travis. I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 273A and open a work session on 273A.
Chair, I move Senate Bill 273A to the floor to be passed.
Representative Barker moves Senate Bill 273A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Bonamici.
Aye.
Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Representative Forrest.
Excused.
Aye.
Aye. Senate Bill 273 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. This passed unanimously in the Senate and now in this committee. Do you think this needs a presentation on the floor, or would the consent calendar be appropriate?
I'm okay with consent on this one.
Okay. Then, if there's no objection, then so ordered. I will now close the work session on Senate Bill 273 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 288.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 288A comes to the request that Senate Interim Judiciary Committee removes the requirement that a parole hearing for someone sentenced to life imprisonment pursuant to ORS 163-105 to 163-115 must be conducted as a contested case hearing applies to hearings conducted on or after the effective date of the act unless the petitioner has petitioned the State Board of Parole and post-prison supervision prior to the effective date of this act. B, the prisoner was eligible for a hearing at the time the petition was filed, and C, the prisoner has not been granted a hearing on the petition that was filed prior to the effective date of this act. Mr. Powers is here from the State Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision.
Mr. Powers.
Thank you, Chair McPherson, members of the committee. My name is Stephen Powers, and I'm chairperson of the Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision. I'm here to present information in support of Senate Bill 288A, which was introduced to remove the requirement of the murder review hearings and what procedures apply. What I plan to do is give you just a quick overview to give you context of the board's process in this area, provide the background on the murder review hearings, and talk about the amendments to the bill in the Senate. The quick overview is that there are 14,015 offenders on parole and post-prison supervision under the board's authority in the community. And there are 13,420 offenders in Department of Corrections custody. Of those 13,000, the board's release authority is of a small percentage of those matrix offenders. Those are those who committed their crime before November 1st, 1989. Those that are sentenced as dangerous offenders no matter when they committed their crime, and those murderers and ag murderers who are eligible for parole. This deals with just the murder review hearing, or the capable of rehabilitation hearing, which deals with that small subset of offenders who are committed aggravated murder or murder and are eligible to be considered for parole. What happened is there's two directions, a sort of a chicken and an egg problem. In Chapter 163, the murder and aggravated murder statutes, there's a direction to hold a hearing, the murder review hearing, under the contested case procedures in the Administrative Procedures Act or the APA in Chapter 183. In Chapter 183, there is an exemption for the board's hearings that the board has applied to its other release hearings, the exit interviews for those matrix offenders, or the parole consideration hearings for those dangerous offenders. And so the exemption is applied to all of the hearings. And the board, in good faith, believed, at least through 1977, that the exemption also applied to murder review hearings. That landscape changed last summer in the Court of Appeals decision in Larson v. Board of Parole. In that Court of Appeals decision, the court looked at the legislative history, looked at the text and context, and determined that the direction in Chapter 163 applies and the exemption does not. What Senate Bill 288A does is harmonizes the board's procedures and says that takes out the direction in Chapter 163 and has the exemption in 183 apply so that the board has contested, holds its hearings like contested case hearings, but not with the specific requirements in the APA. Senate Bill 288A was driven by two major concerns. One is the legislative history, and two is the change of the focus and the potential impact on victims. Going to the first concern, the legislative history, and looking at the legislative history of when Chapter 163 made the direction of hold your hearings under the APA, there was no reasoning in the legislative history that DOJ or the court looked at in terms of why these hearings were singled out for contested case hearing treatment, whereas all the other hearings that passed the constitutional muster were not. And so based on that, and then the second concern being the change on the focus of hearings, one of the provisions under the APA contested case hearings is that the offender can subpoena any person that they want. The concern was that victims could be subpoenaed at that, to appear at that hearing. Also, any person who makes a statement at the board's hearing would be subject to cross-examination. Now, there are other ways possibly that to deal with that, but from the board's view, that subpoena power and the ability for cross-examination was a greater concern, and that's why we put forth Senate Bill 288A. At all of the board hearings, the victims have an opportunity, or the offender supporters have an opportunity, to make a statement to the board. They can make a statement, and then by law, the offender has an opportunity to make a statement, but that statement is directed to the board. Under the contested case proceedings, the focus of the hearing changes, and there could be cross-examination between the offender and the victim's family in this case, and the concern was about re-victimization. Additionally, even if there were opportunities to quash a subpoena or to get out from under the subpoena, it's difficult at times, as they say often, that you can't unring a bell for a victim to receive that subpoena and to have to go through the procedures, hire their own counsel or whatever, to bring that before the board for it to be whether they have to honor that subpoena or not, was part of the re-victimization process that Senate Bill 288A seeks to avoid. Finally, there were some amendments in the Senate to the bill that addressed some but not all of the concerns that were brought up about this measure. First, in Sections 3 and 4, you'll see the emergency clause because the board wanted the ability to harmonize its procedures for its hearings as quickly as possible. In Section 3, there was amendments to create that make and to ensure that those offenders who are in the pipeline, that is, those offenders who have petitions and those offenders who are eligible and have not received a hearing, will get the contested case hearing as required by Larson and by the text of the current Chapter 163 direction. But thereafter, for all those that come after those, they will be subject to Senate Bill 288A and will be under what the board considers its normal hearing process, and the exemption in the APA would apply. That addressed some, again, but not all of the concerns. Additionally, outside the scope of the text of the measure, the board is committed to working with others in creating a rule-based opportunity for witnesses to be called. In our rules for our future disposition hearings for those offenders who are out, there's a provision that allows an offender to call witnesses, that they're still responsible for it, but has that opportunity. We're committed to working with those interested in ensuring that for a rule change to allow for that. We can't do that currently, because as you know, a rule can't trump a statute, and right now the statute allows for witnesses to be called by an offender without having to go through the board. So given all that, the board believes that this is a necessary procedure for a fair hearing that focuses on the sole issue before the board, whether the offender is capable of rehabilitation, and urge a due pass recommendation. Available for questions.
And Mr. Powers, is the problem that arose from the Larson case, is that only relate? Does it only relate to murder proceedings because of the references in ORS 163, 105, and 115? So what about other
parole proceedings for other offenses. Are they done in accordance with the APA?
Chairman Ferguson, members of the committee, they are not. The exemption applies to the board's other hearings, and so they aren't done as contested case proceedings. There are certain, we model our hearings after the APA in terms of notice, and we have specific statutes that talk about what all the information that the board is going to consider needs to go to the offender before the hearing. Those are not contained in the APA in Chapter 183, but are contained in our Chapter 144, the board's specific direction. So to answer your question, the board's other hearings are specifically exempted from the APA, and this would make it consistent with that.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Powers. I'm curious about the, and I know you said in your written testimony that the legislative history is unclear, but I wonder if you have any thoughts on how that language got into the statute. And I notice it doesn't say that it shall be conducted as a contested case hearing. It says it shall be conducted in the manner prescribed for a contested case hearing. But what's your sense on why that was included in the statute?
Chair McPherson, Representative Bonamici, members of the committee, my sense is when the murder review process was created in Chapter 163, they just pointed to the APA, go do the hearings as you have always done. At that time, and then subsequently later, the legislature amended Chapter 183 to exempt the board's hearings because they were their own creature and not a typical administrative procedure. The Court of Appeals looked at that change and said, well, that came and wasn't specifically directed and looked at this, well, are we going to look at 163? Are we going to look at these exemptions? And at the time, the legislature, later the legislature exempted the board, but that exemption didn't go far enough to cover that specific direction in 163. And so you got this two pools of classes. And so I don't know, my sense was that it was just a general direction, look at the APA, and then those later changes of the APA not applying or to the board weren't later encompassed there. And so there wasn't any specific instruction that, oh, we believe the APA had some sort of fundamental due process rights for this type of hearings. It was more of a general thing. That's just my sense.
Representative Krieger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Powers, just I'll get on to this specific in a minute here, but how many cases each year does the parole board deal with on an average?
In terms of murder review hearings, or all, well, the 14,000 offenders that are out in the community, the board has continuing responsibilities over them in terms of issuing warrants, reviewing certain sanctions, expiration when their sentence are. Of the 13,420 that are in Department of Corrections custody, the board has continuing responsibilities for everyone who gets out from Department of Corrections custody. The board has to issue an order of supervision conditions. For release authority, we're dealing with only about 1,600 offenders, and so the pools get smaller. But in terms of the raw number, we're looking at 27,000 people that the board has some continuing responsibility over.
Follow up.
Go ahead.
And how often are they meeting? Is it a full-time job for those people?
For the Board of Parole, yes. It's three full-time members, and we are at our offices every day. And a staff of dedicated and wonderful staff of a total of 15 of all of us, three board members, an executive director, and 11 others.
Just one. Now, with this change, that will reduce your workload a little bit?
It changes the procedures in which Chair McPherson, Representative Krieger, members of the committee. We hope it will. I mean, the murder review hearings will have, regardless of what happens with Senate Bill 288, we believe that it will reduce our workload in terms of keeping us consistent with how we're conducting our hearings. And so, yes, in a way, it does reduce our workload. We'll still have the hearings. It's just a matter of how we're going to conduct them in the more cumbersome process, which we believe, or in our more streamlined process that's focused on what the board does.
Any further questions? Thank you, Mr. Powers. We thank have Becky Duncan from the Office of Public Defense Services.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Becky Duncan. I'm with the Office of Public Defense Services, Appellate Division. Our office opposes Senate Bill 288, and the reason we oppose it is because it changes current law in that it eliminates the contested case requirements for murder review hearings. We think it's appropriate that those contested case requirements apply to murder review hearings because those contested case requirements protect both public and private interests that are, or public and individual interests that are at stake in those hearings. Since we're talking about the contested case provisions, it might be helpful for you to have some background about what these contested case provisions are. As you know, there's an Administrative Procedures Act. It outlines certain procedural requirements that all sorts of state agencies, Department of Motor Vehicles, teacher licensing agency, all sorts of agencies have to follow when they're having contested case hearings. Those provisions excuse me, include things like notice, the right to call witnesses, limiting the evidence to relevant evidence, and the right to subpoena witnesses, the requirement that the agency make findings of fact and establish its conclusions in law in writing. So there's all sorts of basic procedural requirements that the legislature requires agencies, all sorts of agencies in the state, to comply with when they conduct certain hearings. And we think that it is appropriate, as the law, as you can see from the Senate bill, currently requires in two types of hearings that the board has. Those are hearings, murder review hearings for aggravated murderers and for people convicted of regular murder. When those people have served a minimum amount of time, they come before the board for a murder review hearing, or what's sometimes called a rehabilitation hearing. The only issue at that hearing is whether the individual person is capable of rehabilitation within a reasonable period of time. The board has to make that finding. And so what's at issue in this bill is what are the procedures that the board has to follow when it conducts this hearing. And the question before you really is, should the Board of Parole follow the same sorts of procedures in making a decision about a murder sentence as another agency follows when making a decision about licensing or some other agency-type decision? So what we're talking about are the procedures that the Board of Parole has to follow. Should they, as they are currently required, have to provide, as the APA, consistent with the APA, notice and limiting the evidence to relevant evidence, allowing witnesses to be called by the person who has an interest in the hearing, subpoenaing witnesses, making written findings of fact, and making written conclusions of law. So that's the does the legislature want to require those sorts of things for the Board of Parole, just like they require them for all sorts of other agencies? And when you think about this bill, you might want to think of it. There's two different interests at stake. There's the general public interest. What we have here is a person coming before the board, having received a sentence, having been convicted by a jury, and having received a sentence imposed by a judge. And at this point, when the person comes before the board, the sentence is a life sentence. And so now, under the sentencing scheme, it is up to the board, which currently has three individual members, to decide essentially whether to resentence or override that lifetime sentence and impose a possibility of parole sentence. So we're talking about the structurally, how does the legislature want to change what's currently in law, which is before the Board of Parole can convert a life sentence to something less than a life sentence, does it have to comply with the same sorts of procedures that another agency would have to decide, for example, when issuing a teacher's license or making a decision about water rights? I think the public interest at these hearings is significant, in that if you were a juror or a judge and someone had gotten a sentence, would you want the board, before it changed that sentence, to comply with the basic procedures that the APA has for all sorts of hearings? And so we'd think that it would be in the general public interest that before a sentence is converted, changed from life to something less than life, that the board comply with the basic requirements. That's the public interest that's at play here. The individual interests I'll speak to, because our office, the Office of Public Defense Services, is statutorily required to represent people in appeals of these hearings. We do not represent people at these hearings. But when they appeal, like if someone requests, has a rehabilitation hearing and is denied the possibility of parole, then they can appeal that decision, and our office represents them at that point. So what you need to think about on that aspect from the individual perspective, what you need to know about murder and aggravated murder review hearings is that, and you can see this in the bill, the prisoner has the burden of proof in these cases. And that is in Section 2A of your bill. It says the burden of proving by a preponderance of the evidence that the likelihood of rehabilitation, that's the prisoner has to prove his case here. And that's important because among the contested case provisions that the board seeks to eliminate here today are one of the provisions is the provision that the person appearing before the agency has the right to call witnesses and to cross-examine people who give adverse testimony. So what the change would do would change the structure so that the inmate is charged with presenting evidence, but this bill eliminates the APA requirement that that person can call witnesses and cross-examine people who testify against him. So you can see the tension there. The inmate's supposed to prove his case, but this bill would eliminate the statutorily guaranteed means for the inmate to do that because it takes away the subpoena power and the cross-examination right. And so that's something that we think should give you pause, and we don't think that that's a good change. Now, of course, we understand a concern about calling in the family members of murder victims and subjecting them to subpoenas or cross-examination. No one thinks that's a good idea. I don't think someone having a murder review hearing would think that it would be a good idea to in any way harass the family members of if someone has been in prison for 30 years and they're going to appear before the board and ask to get out, I don't think they'd think it would be a good idea to go and subpoena the family members of the victims and have them come into the board and be harassed. I understand that the board's saying that is one of the reasons they need this bill. If all this bill did was provide that someone having a murder review hearing could not subpoena or cross-examine a family member of a victim, we would have no problem with that. But that's not what it does. It takes away the right to subpoena and cross-examine regardless of who the witness is. And we think that that's problematic. If someone is going to come in and testify that the person having the hearing is not capable of rehabilitation, except for a family member or victim, we think that, for example, like a psychologist or a counselor at the prison is going to come in and say, oppose the granting of parole, we think that if that person gives testimony, that person should be subject to cross-examination, and that this bill is overly broad in that it would eliminate that possibility. So given the unique burden of the murder review hearings, we think it's appropriate that these certain procedural protections, which have been in place, and you can see them, and Representative Bonamici, you read the language, that the statute said that the proceedings are to be conducted in a manner prescribed in contested case hearings. That's what the law currently requires. We think it's appropriate given the public and individual interests at stake. And what's interesting to note as far as the legislative history is that this language existed in the early 70s. It was created in the aggravated murder statutes. But the murder statutes, this language was added in 1999, indicating as recently as 1999, this is how the legislature thought the board was going to conduct these hearings, which is to say they were going to conduct them like we conduct DMV hearings, teacher licensing hearings, water board hearings. Basic procedural requirements. We think they're appropriate given everyone's interest in these cases, and I'd be happy to answer any questions if you have them.
Ms. Duncan, wouldn't the arguments you're making about needing a contested case hearing kind of proceeding apply to other lesser crimes other than murder, and yet our statutes don't provide for that? So are you suggesting we should be requiring contested case hearings for all? I realize it's not your argument, but
right.
Wouldn't the logic extend to that argument?
I think the big problem and the big distinction between these types of hearings is that the statutory burden, the statute itself puts the burden on the offender. So it's particularly important when the offender has to prove the case to give the offender subpoena rights and cross-examination rights. If the board has to prove a negative, which they do, if the board has to prove something, if they bear the burden, which they do in what are called exit interview cases, if you have a non murder offender. He goes through the matrix system, and they calculate a date for his release. As that date approaches, the board can hold what's called an exit interview. If the board affirmatively finds something, like, for example, that the person doesn't have an appropriate release plan, a parole plan, if the board finds that, then they can decide to postpone his release. But the offender doesn't have to prove anything there, so it's less important for the offender. He doesn't have to make a case, so it's less important that he has these provisions for making a case. And the other thing is, I think that the legislature could very well decide that we're talking about converting a murder sentence. And so for these cases, the public's interest for this type of sentence, to change it from life to life with the possibility of parole, this is kind of like a resentencing more than it is in other parole hearings. And before the result of the jury's verdict and the judge's sentence is changed, the board has to undertake the same type of hearing as other agencies do. I think the legislature could distinguish, based on the nature of this sentence and the seriousness of this crime, that what the jury and judge says stays unless the board does what the law requires, which is have this type of hearing. So the burden, because of the burden and because of the seriousness of the crimes, I think this is how, that is probably why the legislature has put the contested case requirement into the statute.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Duncan, you said that this would eliminate the possibility of cross-examination, but would it necessarily eliminate cross-examination, or could a witness still be cross-examined if this bill went into effect?
It eliminates the statutory right to it, and so then it's completely up to the board.
Counsel Taylor.
Ms. Duncan, you're saying, I thought I heard you said that this bill would be more acceptable to you if there were an amendment to the bill that would preclude the calling the victim's family. Is that correct? Or what kind of limitations would you want on that?
Mr. Chair, counsel, yes, we understand that there's a legitimate interest in not having victims come to these hearings and be cross-examined by offenders, and I think there wouldn't be a problem with saying, amending the statute to say at the hearing, the offender has, the representatives of the victim may make a statement to the board, but that statement is not subject to cross-examination. And I don't think there would be a problem saying that the offender cannot subpoena a representative of the victim. Now, I think all of that's fine. I also think it's unnecessary, and let me tell you why. These hearings, the only issue in these hearings is whether the offender's capable of rehabilitation. And so under current law, I do not think, unless the representative of the victim had something to say, like that the offender had demonstrated that he, you know, was sorry and he'd apologize. I mean, I just do not think that this is something where the offender is going to have a basis for calling anyone or questioning anyone, a representative of the victim at these hearings, given the limited scope of the hearing. But
Ms. Duncan, I would assume that if they subpoenaed a witness that did not have relevant information, for example, a family member of the victim, that there'd be an ability to seek to quash that subpoena based on relevancy?
Mr. Chair, counsel, there's two things to note there. If the offender is represented by an attorney, the attorney could issue the subpoena, but of course the attorney is an officer of the court and is not going to be allowed, well, should not be allowed to subpoena somebody who doesn't have anything to do at, to say at the hearing, which would be the attorney couldn't subpoena someone who, like the family member of the victim, has nothing to say about the rehabilitation. That's the attorney check. The more important check that you might be concerned about is that if the inmate is represented pro se, the inmate doesn't issue the subpoena. The board issues the subpoena. So the inmate would ask the board to issue the subpoena. The board would get the request and say, that's the victim, that's a family member of the victim. That person has no no role in this hearing, given the scope of the hearing. So we're not even going to issue the subpoena. So if the attorneys, if there's an attorney, the attorney shouldn't represent it, shouldn't issue the subpoena. If it's a pro se offender, that subpoena is never going to get issued because the board's not going to issue it. So the victim isn't going to receive the subpoena and have to have it quashed. It's just not even going to go out. If it did wrongfully go out, then it could be quashed.
Committee, we're running out of time, and we're also down three members, so it's my intention not to, to work this bill today. What I'm going to do is close the public hearing and then roll it over, the work session, to tomorrow. And what I would suggest to the witnesses we've heard from, if you haven't already visited with the members who are missing here from today, you may want to do that before tomorrow's work session. I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 288. That concludes our agenda for today. Thank you, committee. We're adjourned.